Opinion.
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 Welcome to the first ever Podiatry Institute podcast. My name is Annette Filiatro. I'm the current Podiatry Institute chairperson and will serve as the moderator. Today we have chosen to discuss second metatarsophalangeal joint instability as it provides a challenging topic for our three distinguished physicians with us today, whom are Dr. Alan Banks, Thomas Roski, and Mickey Stapp. Before we start, are there any financial disclosures?
Yes, I do have a disclosure from Crossroads, which is the Strop planar plate repair system, and Carbofix, which is a metal company.
This is Mickey Stapp. I was on advisory board, a company called MTP Solutions that helped design and develop instrumentation and techniques for repair of left to metatarsal phalangeal joint, and then continue on advisory board with Smith & Nephew, who now markets that instrumentation and procedure.
And I'm Alan Banks, and I have no disclosures.
All right, what we're going to do is, let's imagine a middle-aged patient presenting with a medial crossover second toe with a moderate bunion. We're going to start with Dr. Banks. What are some of the things that you look for clinically in evaluating the second metatarsophalangeal joint?
Well, as I look at this, first of all, I want to know whether or not the patient has symptoms. Is this something which is symptomatic just because the toe is overlapping and being irritated from the shoes, or whether the MPJ itself is a problem as far as the symptom complex? Beyond that, I want to assess reducibility, the flexibility. Also, I want to assess whether or not there is instability at that metatarsophalangeal joint through the dorsal subluxation test or whatever means that you may find is effective in doing that. And then based upon that, I will then kind of take the second step as far as recommendations. Obviously, we'll want to take a look at x-rays and things, but just clinically, I want to know, is it reducible? Is it symptomatic? Does it appear as if there's instability at the joint?
This is Mickey Stapp. So I agree, a lot of these often present with pain at the joint without symptomatology of the hammer toe itself, especially in the early process of the hammer toe. So I usually direct my treatment at that symptomatology of the second metatarsal phalangeal joint, and will instruct the patient that oftentimes I can resolve that inflammation but can't necessarily correct the deformity that's present or prevent the progression of the deformity that most likely will occur. But oftentimes it's not the hammer toe that brings them in as much as the joint pain at the second or other left metatarsal phalangeal joint, usually the second. As far as contemplation or my exam, consideration of a surgery, is I agree also we want to see if it's reducible. Is there instability clinically through a drawer test or a Lachman's test type procedure? And does that produce pain and or instability? So oftentimes the inflammation of the joint does not require surgery. The deformity, if it becomes worse and painful, may require surgery later.
And this is Tom Broski, and I agree with both Dr. Banks and Dr. Stapp. The first thing I typically do is look at and assess the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. I want to see if there's any instability, any arthritic changes of the joint. And the reality is there any, the pathology that you see at the second MPJ, number one, the main question is how long has this been going on for? And number two, is there any subtle changes or any swelling in the joint? I typically will have the patient stand and look at both feet to see if there's any subtle changes. And typically what I'll see is some mild edematous changes dorsally, which will obscure the extensor tendon on that particular joint. And then I treat it just like Dr. Banks and Dr. Stapp in a kind of a sequence of events. I want to look at x-rays and see if there's any subtle changes, joint distension, any medial deviation of the joint itself. And then we go in a stepwise approach to see if the patient will fail conservative treatment, and obviously then we'll need surgery, and that we'll discuss that coming up.
So what are some of the things that you're looking for, clues radiographically for a patient like this?
I think we all want to take a look at just the metatarsal parabola and just see how the second metatarsal lines up relative to the first. Is the first short? Is there a problem? Otherwise, certainly we want to take a look at whether or not there's any medial deviation at the second MPJ. And then, you know, structurally at the metatarsal head, in some of these people, there's an old Freiberg's or something of that nature, or whether or not there's any early arthritic change. All these things have an influence, I think, on all of us as far as how we might approach it conservatively or surgically.
And I think oftentimes when we're seeing these patients present with their painful second toe, whether it's crossover or not, sometimes I'll make the diagnosis from looking at x-ray even before I go into the room, just from the medial deviation without any change in the sagittal plane on a lateral radiograph. So as soon as we start seeing that medial deviation, oftentimes we'll know that's the patient's complaint when they say that they're having pain at the ball of their foot. And they're like, oh, how did you know where it was? Well, we've already had some hint from the radiographic findings. But most of the time I will see these, of course, a crossover, we'll see medial and dorsal dislocation of the metatarsal end joint. But most of the time I don't see arthritic changes of the joint. The joint is still pretty pristine, yet maybe dislocated or subluxed, but without signs of arthritic changes.
And I completely agree with that. I use the main focus of my exam is the clinical exam. Radiographs are looked at, like Dr. Banks mentioned, to confirm the parabola, if there is any incidental degenerative changes. But the reality is the clinical exam tells me the picture of what I'm treating. And then I look at the first metatarsal phalangeal joint under x-ray and just look at the whole picture. But the clinical exam is the most important for me.
And how often would you say you use MRI or ultrasound in diagnosis or evaluation of these patients?
I would say that I rarely will order an MRI or an ultrasound. Like I mentioned earlier, my clinical exam and the length of time the patient's been dealing with this pathology to me is much more important.
Yeah, this is Mickey Stepp. I would agree. I would rarely use MRI to make the diagnosis or even assist in my planning of surgical correction.
Let's just briefly touch on what you do conservatively for these patients, and then we'll move on to surgical approaches. I'll start with Mickey. What do you do conservatively?
If the patient's presenting with the severe joint inflammation and not necessarily a structural pain in shoe gear, I usually address it at the inflammation of the second metatarsal phalange joint. Yes, that may be the predislocation syndrome or the one that develops prior to them developing the full crossover hammer toe, but usually address the inflammation of the joint. I tend to utilize, because I think it is a difficult inflammation to resolve, I tend to utilize an oral corticosteroid first. Historically, I did not. I found that the non-steroidals weren't oftentimes strong enough, or patients could not take them, so I tend to go more immediately to a corticosteroid orally, and then follow that. If a patient's a good candidate for non-steroidal, I'll immediately follow after, say, a 10 or 12 day course of a corticosteroid with a non-steroidal. I also use splintage, whether it be a commercially available toe splint or whether I demonstrate toe strapping, as well as ice, supportive shoes, all of those kind of conservative measures. I rarely use corticosteroid injections. I do occasionally use those if someone is not responding and their main complaint is that joint inflammation and not the structure.
I agree with all the above. The only addition I will add is that I will inject plantarly along the flexor sheath. I'll go in underneath the base of the toe and just drop in about a half cc of dexamethasone and a half cc of marcaine. Because I do believe there's some pathology along the flexor tendon inferiorly, and I'm seeing some good results with that injection, but I'm very careful on where I inject.
I probably inject more than the previous two speakers because I find that it works and it's very successful for many patients. I do agree with Tom that I think the unrecognized or the under-discussed component of this symptom complex is the long flexor tendon. And there was actually a paper published in our journal a number of years ago where they injected local anesthetic into the flexor sheath, just local anesthetic alone, and patients had significant symptomatic improvement while the local anesthetic was in effect. So to me, this indicates there's more to this than just the plantar plate. And secondly, I would say I probably use orthotics or some type of support along with either metatarsal arch pad or pontoon padding. And then if I don't achieve adequate relief with those, I will put patients in a Kelm walker for 4 to 6 weeks. And that typically will also be a successful modality in those patients who are more resistant.
This Mickey step, one point as far as the flexor sheath, and I know that is part of it, and even intraoperatively, surgically, you can see adhesion in a really bad flexor plate to the long flexor. But I think in your clinical exam, I try to discern if the patient is painful both dorsally and plantarly and with range of motion of the joint, because you can palpate pure dorsal joint line and they have pain, and we know then it's not only, you know, long flexor, but long flexor is obviously part of it. And then with extreme in range of motion, both plantar flexion and dorsiflexion will usually produce pain when you're checking for that reducibility.
I had a follow-up question for Dr. Banks. If you do a steroid injection, do you do anything to warn the patient or protect, tell them to be extra careful after the injection or not?
You know, I see and hear much discussion about steroid injections possibly perpetuating a dislocation of the joint. And what I can tell you is I've never seen that. Okay, I have never seen that in practice over 30 years. Now, I'm not saying that it couldn't occur, but what I would say is this. If the patient has a joint dislocation, it is probably not the steroid. It is probably the precursor, and that is the months, in many instances, of chronic inflammation. I mean, patients dislocate without steroid injections. That's what we see in our practice. Most of these people who have dislocated joints have never had an injection of any kind in their foot. So what I would say is the greater risk is allowing the inflammation to continue to progress. That is the greatest risk to dislocation as opposed to the steroid infiltration.
Great, thank you. So we're going to turn our attention now to surgery, and of course it's difficult without a specific patient or x-rays in front of you, but just in general, with this type of patient, do you have a stepwise or surgical approach that you find to work best in your hands? Start with Dr. Stapp.
Again, it's difficult without a typical patient or exact patient in front of us. Traditionally, I still do a dorsal approach, repairing whatever deformity they may have of the digit, and that's typically an arthrodesis to provide that stability at the lesser metatarsal phalange joint. Because of my background and working on this, I tend to try to repair flexor plate and collateral ligaments. We realize now collateral ligaments are much more important than we once thought or understood, especially with a medial crossover. So I tend to do more dorsal approach, trying to preserve those structures about the metatarsal and metatarsal phalange joint, and then reattach and repair both collaterals and flexor plate in this scenario where it's a crossover, you know, medial crossover second toe.
And this is Tom Broski. I completely agree with Mickey. The only addition I will add is that I typically treat all the soft tissue in the area just like a normal hammer toe sequence. I'll load the foot, and if there is any medial deviation of the second MP joint and it's resisting a neutral position, I want to continue the soft tissue repair, and then I will switch to the plantar plate, and that's usually my last sequence of events that occur. And I will do it from a dorsal approach. I do use the Strop procedure, so I'm a little biased to this because all my previous procedures were a plantar plate, so that was a plantar incision for the reduction of the plate, and I've switched to the more dorsal approach, and I find it much easier with this technique.
Echoing the two previous points, I would just say I use a dorsal approach. I've gone plantarly rarely in the past and not been pleased with the outcome. I think there's a tremendous amount of stiffness that develops, and many of these people, while they don't have a hypertrophic scar, they develop a callus in the scar, which is equally symptomatic to them. So I just like to avoid that plantar skin, at least in this circumstance. I believe that the collateral ligaments are very important. I also believe that the flexor tendon, the long flexor, is important. Again, the under-discussed component of this whole complex, because in some of these patients, we will see a long flexor tendon which is deviated medial to the central axis of the joint. And once that long flexor is deviated medially, its action is no longer going to be pure plantar flexion, it's also going to be medial deviation. So centralization of that flexor tendon, I think, is sometimes needed and important as a component of the repair.
Intraoperatively, I found on occasion that the flexor plate is so attenuated, I was not able to repair it or to tag it back to the plantar side of the base of the proximal phalanx. So you often do find the flexor tendon is not central. And in those instances where I have not had a good flexor plate repair, I have tagged flexor tendon, much as Dr. Banks taught me 30 years ago, I guess, on tagging long flexor to the hallux and doing a Keller. Same principle, and it does centralize the long flexor and does provide stability without, I think, the stiffness.
Dr. Broski, do you want to talk a little bit about when you'll add a while osteotomy to your repair?
That's an important question, because generally when you're using the dorsal approach, with Mickey's technique, there's no real need for an osteotomy. But with my approach, I typically do a while procedure, and it's basically for access of the plantar plate if there is a repair going on. So that's, I guess you could say, a negative aspect of this particular technique. You have to do a while procedure with this.
This is Mickey Stepp. Regardless of the technique, I think back to your evaluation of the patient, you almost want to discern if their pain is of the joint level or is submetatarsal head. And I think there's some difference to that. Also look at their hyperkeratotic lesion pattern before I would even consider a while osteotomy. I don't try to judge that or make that decision just based on radiographs. So if they're not painful, beneath the metatarsal head or no callus pattern, even if it's long and most of their pain is within the capsule joint itself, then I'll typically not do a while osteotomy.
This is Alan Banks, and I will occasionally perform a while. If I have a patient where I'm convinced that that second MPJ is overloaded, and I think that's essentially what we're talking about, is this joint has been overloaded mechanically for one reason or another, I will do a while, and I will shorten maybe 2 or 3 millimeters. I don't believe in shortening more than that, but I just want to reduce the mechanical load to that joint. So I think it helps those patients who are symptomatic with that joint prior to the surgery, where they haven't responded to conservative care. In some instances, I will do the while, and I may not shorten, but I will displace a little bit in the transverse plane just to try and, again, balance those soft tissues around that joint a little more effectively.
Then, quickly, how many of you are pinning across the joint? What are your feelings about pinning across the metatarsal phalangeal joint?
I rarely will pin across the joint. On revisional cases, when I'm doing a partial med head resection, obviously that's a different scenario, but For a general repair, I just don't have much experience with pinning the joint. I've seen some stiffness postoperatively on other patients, so I kind of stay away from that technique.
I still do occasionally pin across the metatarsal flange joint, depending on what type of fixation I may be utilizing in my arthrodesis of the hammer toe. I don't routinely do it by any means. And depending on what type of repair I did at the metatarsal flange joint, some systems will not allow that. So I do occasionally do it. I'm not adamantly opposed to it by any means, but it's very limited.
This is Alan Banks, and in those situations where I'm not performing an osteotomy on the metatarsal and I'm not repairing a flexor plate, if it's more of a soft tissue release and then rebalancing those soft tissues, I will tighten up the lateral capsule. In some instances, I actually transfer the long flexor to the lateral side of the joint apparatus. If I'm doing purely a soft tissue technique, I routinely pin across the MPJ with the toe and a little plantar flexion and a little bit of lateral displacement. There is no bandage that will hold that toe where you want it, but the K-wire will do so effectively.
And are you keeping that in about 3 to 4 weeks, typically?
If I don't release anything plantarly, I keep it in the entire 6 weeks. I've not found a problem with stiffness. The problem with stiffness comes when you're working on the plantar side of the joint and then pin it for that long. So yes, now I do, in older patients or situations where we have no stability whatsoever, sometimes do a partial metatarsal head resection. And originally I would leave that wire crossed for 6 weeks, and if you want a stiff joint, you'll get one. So I have started retracting that wire at 3 to 4 weeks, and that has helped.
What have you found to push you towards doing a partial met head resection versus the other things we've talked about?
In many instances, age of the patient. If the toe is dorsally dislocated and it has been that way for a long time, I think it's going to be hard for you to find a way to maintain that digit and that articulation in a rectus manner. If we have multiple articulations that are involved, I tend to lean more toward partial metatarsal head resection. So those would be just some of the scenarios. But in those patients where the deformity is a dislocated or a severely subluxed joint, it's been that way for years, I just think it's going to be very difficult otherwise to achieve the correction that we would like long term.
And then just in general, let's discuss what your overall post-op protocol is for these patients.
This is Tom Broski. With a generalized repair of the plantar plate from a dorsal approach, I'll typically place the patient in a posterior splint on the table. They'll wear it for 6 days. And they'll come in with a pneumatic cam walker to be worn for a couple weeks, typically. I will stress the weight bearing along the forefoot and try to get those patients to stay on their heel for the first couple weeks to kind of offload the joint. But I rarely will cast these patients, so to speak, for this technique.
This is Mickey Stapp, and depending on the other procedures that may have gone along with this patient, but I tend to protect most of them in a pneumatic walking boot for around 4 weeks. If it's just a arthrodesis of a digit and a metatarsal flange joint soft tissue repair, and then progress them into other casual shoes and or sandals.
And then lastly, let's just talk about, do you treat revisional cases differently than what we just discussed above? And if so, how?
Like Dr. Banks mentioned, when the deformity has been present for a long time, and significant contracture, the age of the patient, all these factors, I utilize more joint destructive procedures. So the plantar plate repair typically on these long-standing deformities is very challenging. Sometimes there's no plate available for repair, so then I switch to more of a joint destructive procedure and pinning the joint for, like Dr. Banks mentioned, typically 4 to 6 weeks.
Yes, Mickey Stapp. And it depends what procedures were performed, the first or second or third go-around, and if you can figure that out or track down op notes to help you determine what was attempted and what was performed. I still utilize digital amputations in some of these revisional cases, and the elderly patient and their main complaint is their crossover second toe. I still think I give that to them oftentimes as a viable option with a 2-week healing time versus an attempted reconstructive surgery with months of healing time and not the predictability, even with the newer techniques, still not the predictability as oftentimes as a simple amputation.
This is Alan Banks, and you remind me of Tom Smith's old adage that if grandma didn't need to count to 20, she didn't need that toe. Yes. And so, you know, there are places for that, and I've actually done that myself in some of my very mature patients in the past, where all they wanted to do was wear their shoe comfortably because the overlapping toe was so severe. One other component that I think we need to assess clinically in the more advanced deformity or the recurrent deformity, and that is the soft tissue, in particular the skin. And I've had patients with long-standing deformity where the relocation of the digit was impeded by skin contracture dorsomedially. And certainly that you could talk about skin plasties, but I just think if the deformity is that great, it's more reliable to do a partial metatarsal head resection. So in patients who've had multiple procedures or prior surgery, we're also looking at scar tissue, which may impede our capacity to relocate. And so if I'm looking at a revisional surgery or someone who's had a couple of procedures, I'm trying to find what I would believe would be the most reliable approach for that patient at that time. That would be partial metatarsal head resection.
Well, that's the end of our podcast. I want to thank Dr. Alan Banks, Dr. Mickey Stapp, and Dr. Thomas Brosky for joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You can delete that.
Made with Opinion, the world's first easy-to-use podcasting app.
Welcome to the first ever Podiatry Institute podcast. My name is Annette Filiatra. I'm the current Podiatry Institute chairperson and will serve as moderator. We have chosen today to discuss second metatarsal flanger joint instability, as it provides a challenging topic for our three distinguished physicians with us today, whom are Dr. Alan Banks, Dr. Thomas Dabrowski, and Dr. Mickey Stapp. So let's get right into it. Let's imagine a middle-aged patient presenting with a medial crossover second toe, otherwise known as a plantar plate dysfunction deformity with a moderate bunion. Starting with you, Dr. Banks, what are some of the things that you look for clinically in evaluating the second metatarsal phalangeal joint?